Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, contributing host Doug Becker explores why there are protests in Hong Kong and what are the stakes for both China and internationally.
I'm Doug Becker. In February of 2019, Hong Kong's government announced a new extradition law that for the first time would allow for the extradition of accused criminals from Hong Kong to mainland China. This decision compelled opposition in Hong Kong, culminating in a mass demonstration on April the 28th. It was the largest since the Umbrella Movement in 2014. Hong Kong's government tried to mollify the protesters, but to no avail. Opposition to the government's decision then swelled to mass protests, numbering at least in the hundreds of thousands by early June. Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lim announced the suspension of the bill, but protesters continued their mass action, demanding a more permanent guarantee that the law will not be revived. The protests continue today. In today's show, we will examine the causes of the protests, the history of Hong Kong and its relationship with China, what China's options with these protests are, and likely international responses to China's policies. Today, we are joined by Daniel Lynch, who is at City University in Hong Kong. He is author of several books and articles, including The End of China's Rise. Pradeep Taneja is a lecturer in Chinese politics, political economy, and international relations at the University of Melbourne. He is also the associate of the Center for Contemporary Chinese Studies and a fellow of the Australia-India Institute. His publications include China Since 1978. And Catherine Chu at California State University at Dominguez Hills, who is the author of So You Think You Know Chinese Film, Beyond Jackie Chan and Crouching Tiger. Daniel Lynch, my first question is to you. Since you're in Hong Kong, can you give us a description of what's going on currently and what's expected to develop over the course of, say, the next week or two?
Well, the organization that had been planning and requesting special permission to hold the peaceful protests had requested for the last weekend of August to hold a march, a protest and a march from the central district of Hong Kong Island over to the western part of the island, where is located the Chinese Communist Party's representative office in Hong Kong, the Beijing liaison office. So because the police were concerned that could lead to violence, could lead to throwing petrol bombs and so on like that, the police have just very recently denied permission for that march. And this has caused people to become, protesters become very angry. Speculation is they are going nevertheless to march, and so there's worry that this weekend will be violent. There is also talk now of holding another general strike, a Hong Kong-wide general strike, Monday, September 2nd. That would be comparable to the strike 3-4 weeks ago now, 3.5 weeks ago. That was also accompanied by the shutdown of the Hong Kong airport. So the coming few days could be days of violence and certainly days of tense confrontation between the protesters and the Hong Kong government with Beijing backing.
And what exactly is the cause of these protests?
Well, that's a very complex and long story. I think if you look at the slogan, the primary slogan that the protesters are spray painting all over the place and articulating to the media, they're using the term in Chinese, Guangfu Xiangyang. Guangfu Xiangyang is comparable, means technically recover Hong Kong. And it's the same terminology that the KMT, the Chinese Nationalist Government in Taiwan, used beginning in the mid and late 1940s to refer to the retrocession of Taiwan from colonial imperial Japan back to the Republic of China, or to the Republic of China. So in other words, there's an analogy here. The Hong Kong protesters are saying we need to recover Hong Kong in a way analogous to the recovery of Taiwan by China from Imperial Japan back, you know, in the first part of the 20th century. I think that is because many Hong Kong people feel since the retrocession to Chinese sovereignty in 1997 that they've lost something. There's been a lot of mainlander migration to Hong Kong, a lot of mainlander tourists and sort of day traders come to Hong Kong. A lot of students, of course, many Hong Kong people recognize that these people from the mainland, these Chinese people, make very positive contributions to Hong Kong life, economy, and so on. But a lot of other Hong Kongers, especially, I think, younger Hong Kongers, I think the data bear this out, feel like they haven't benefited from this migration of lots of people from the mainland down here to Hong Kong, and they feel like they've lost something. They feel like their community, their city has changed in the last couple of decades, and they want to recover, sort of to restore what they feel was its excellence from decades past. And I will just say one more thing about this. The inequality levels here in Hong Kong are really terrible, not off the charts, but very bad. And it's true in a lot of places under globalization. A lot of people simply don't benefit or win from globalization. And specifically here in East and Southeast Asia, a lot of people have not benefited economically from the kind of China-centered globalization we've seen here. So there's a disinvestment from places like Hong Kong or Taiwan or South Korea over into China. That's led to a stagnation of wages and salaries in places like Hong Kong. So a lot of the younger people who are out there demonstrating really don't feel they have much of an economic future. And, you know, because another factor is people in China have done very, very well economically. A lot of people from the mainland have bought property here in Hong Kong, so it's extremely expensive to live here, to buy a flat or to buy just about anything. And so the economic prospects for a lot of the young people demonstrating are also not too bright. So I think you have economic and identity, and of course just political factors too, because people don't really generally like to live in oppressive communist systems. They're all three combining to stimulate the protests.
So Catherine Chu, Dan Lynch had suggested some of this has to do certainly with history and with identity, and in particular the idea of sort of freeing Hong Kong, even a suggestion that perhaps we should start viewing Hong Kong as a colony or as territory that's been seized by Beijing. What ultimately is behind, particularly the younger generation of people in Hong Kong and their relationship with Beijing, that might give kind of a broader context to these demonstrations?
Yeah. Before I answer your question, I want to add something to Professor Lynch just mentioned about the slogan that very, very popular. Actually, you can find everywhere right now in Hong Kong, that is like the Guang Fu Hong Kong in Cantonese. So what's that exactly mean? Actually, even the translation from Cantonese or from Chinese to English right now is quite controversial, because even to the people in Hong Kong, we all have different meaning on that slogan. So just one of the explanations like Professor Lynch just mentioned is kind of like restore the best age, best time of Hong Kong, even no matter maybe it's during the colonial period or even just after the 1997. But whenever, what I want to add is actually the definition is very, very complicated, and then every Hong Kong people, they have their own meaning. But the overall for that is really about our identity, Hong Konger. So I think I can go back to your question. After 1997, right now, actually, it's already like 22 years, and the Chinese government or even the Hong Kong government tried very hard to educate or to change the Hong Kong identity. For example, like every night before the news, like at 6:30 or 6 o'clock, they will have a national anthem, and then also the patriotic education. They changed the textbook. Right now, actually, it's not politically correct to call Hong Kong was a colony. Actually, it's not a colony, okay, based on the version right now in Hong Kong. I just read an article this morning. It's from The Economist magazine. They have a survey, and the survey actually was finished in 2019. And very surprising about the result is the people from Hong Kong under the age of 30, nearly 0% of them, they believe that they are Chinese. They claim themselves they are Hong Kongers. So this survey actually they were done in 2018. It means actually it's before the whole protest. So it's quite obvious. Even though after return over, okay, and then even though these young people, most of them actually they were born after the colonial period, after 1997, but no matter what did the Chinese government do, or even the Hong Kong government try very hard to push on the patriotic education to the people in Hong Kong, but it looks like it's failed. The whole project, the whole campaign, it failed, because more and more young people, they just don't feel like they want to claim to be Chinese. They just want their identity to be Hong Kongers. So I think that is kind of a relationship. Why such kind of this kind of campaign, this bill, when it proposed in the early of 2019, it brought so many people out. And actually, I want to correct your introduction. Actually, this is not the biggest anti-government protest after 2014, the Umbrella Movement. Actually, it is the biggest ever in Hong Kong's history. even bigger than 1989. And then right now, the period for the protest is already longer than the umbrella movement.
I stand corrected. Absolutely. Yeah. Of course, those are the images that we're getting of these mass protests. Now, Pradeep Taneja, these images certainly must be having an impact regionally, you know, as well. What are some of the perceptions from the region that, in particular, that would likely contrast with some of the images that we might be getting here in American news?
It is true that China has invested heavily, particularly after Tiananmen Square, in trying to improve its soft power. I mean, there's been a perception that China has a negative soft power, and China has been investing very heavily in trying to improve that soft power. So I think what's happening in Hong Kong, it kind of plays into that narrative of China having a negative soft power, because the general perception around the region is that China's handling of dissidents within China, but also particularly in Hong Kong, has really been very negative in terms of China's image overseas. Now, we know that many governments in the region will not say anything openly. They will not criticize China openly. But in terms of the media and the general public, the perception certainly is that China is incapable of dealing with the demands of the protesters in Hong Kong without jeopardizing the internal the stability which the CCP so cherishes. So overall, I think the protests in Hong Kong are being read outside China, and particularly in the region. I'm based in Australia, and certainly in Australia, these protests are being reported daily by electronic media and the print media. On social media, you hear a lot about these protests in Hong Kong, and everyone is watching. I think the world is watching with a bated breath as to how China responds to the Hong Kong protests. We know that China has condemned this statement by the G7 summit in France. The G7 summit, of course, has said or reaffirmed the existence of the 1984 joint declaration between Britain and Hong Kong, and they've also called for calm. Now, the Chinese foreign ministry has condemned that statement. So clearly, the response to concern by the international community to the protest in Hong Kong and the situation in Hong Kong, from China, the response has been to condemn and say that there are dark forces trying to interfere. And personally, I think that's not going to play very well in the international community, because there is a great deal of concern among the citizens in the Asia Pacific region, who are actually looking at the Hong Kong situation with grave concern.
I'm Doug Becker. You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. Today we are discussing the ongoing protests in Hong Kong, China's response, and likely outcomes. So, Dan Lynch, one of the concerns, you know, has been how might China respond? The nightmare scenario we keep hearing is a potential return to Tiananmen Square, or at least some version of just sending the military. What options does China have to respond to the protests, and what's at stake with respect to some of these different potential options?
Yeah, well, this relates to your previous question there about responses in the region, because as you know, in January in Taiwan, the government will hold elections for the president and for the legislature. And, of course, Taiwan is another territory that the CCP, the Chinese Communist Party, claims as a part of China, even though it's been run autonomously with de facto sovereignty ever since the late 1940s, ever since it was handed over again to the KMT from Japan. So in order to convince Taiwan peacefully to unify with China, with the mainland, CCP has since the late 1970s pursued this policy of plan of implementing one country, two systems, just like it's implementing or trying to implement in Hong Kong as well as Macau. So I happened to be in Taiwan for 7 weeks this summer, just as the demonstrations were exploding in Hong Kong. And I can say categorically that it conclusively convinced even the handful of the 20% of the Taiwan people who may have thought maybe we can think about one country, two systems, that it's a totally bankrupt, failed system. Nevertheless, there's probably still some hope in the minds of Chinese leaders that if they handle Hong Kong's current crisis successfully without using violence and force, they might still be able to convince some Taiwanese to come to an agreement along similar lines. But in the meantime, the candidate that China was pushing hardest and backing most enthusiastically in the presidential election race for January, Han Guoyu, the mayor of Kaohsiung, he's only been a mayor for a short period of time, he has really fumbled and mishandled his response to the Hong Kong protests. Even during the first couple of weeks, claimed he hadn't heard there were any protests in Hong Kong, which is quite implausible. So his fortunes have really sunk in tandem with the intensification of the Hong Kong protests. So it's looking pretty good right now for the incumbent president of Taiwan, Tsai Ing-wen, who is the candidate of the Democratic Progressive Party, which has always been the pro-independence, so-called Green Party in Taiwan. So nevertheless, Xi Jinping and China need to think very carefully about how to handle the current crisis in Hong Kong, because if there's any sort of lapse in uncontrollable violence, that'll just create even bigger fissures with Taiwan. Now, in terms of what they could do, you know, the whole Tiananmen scenario or analogy seems completely misplaced to me. That was already 30 years ago, where you had demonstrators in China and Beijing and many other cities, actually, but especially in Beijing, gathering right in the center of the city, and in a way where it was actually fairly easy for military forces to put them down and kill hundreds of them. So here in Hong Kong, the scenario would be quite different. First of all, it wouldn't likely be the People's Liberation Army. It would be the People's Armed Police, so it's a paramilitary force. If they were to cross the border and come into Hong Kong, they would be having to deal with protesters who are dispersed all over the territory and who know have the home field advantage insofar as they know Hong Kong very well. Hong Kong is a three-dimensional city. You know, it's not just flat and on the ground. You've got to go up buildings, across skywalks, and in and out and down into train stations and everything. So the Hong Kong protesters would have a major home field advantage. There is a People's Liberation Army garrison, several thousand forces, several thousand military personnel, let's say, stationed in Hong Kong. I've met some of these people. My impression is that they're really more public relations type military officers. I'm not saying they couldn't fight if they needed to, but they're not armed to the teeth and looking for a fight, in my personal impression. So I think the CCP will do everything it can to let the Hong Kong authorities deal with these protests, and which means possibly putting in place some sort of emergency regulations that would allow the police to arrest more people and to become more aggressive in their tactics. Just this past weekend, for the first time, they deployed water cannon, which they might do more of in the future, and in general, escalate their tactics. I really don't think, with the 70th anniversary of the founding of the PRC coming up on October 1st, and then next January 11th, the elections in Taiwan coming up, in the context of this very tense U.S.-China relationship right now, I really don't think Xi Jinping and the CCP would want to introduce forces somehow from the mainland into Taiwan, into Hong Kong, especially given the home field advantage and the just incendiary nature of what that would mean in the weeks ahead. Let me, if I could just say one other thing about that, though. I personally can't understand. It looks like the CCP is holding back and preventing Carrie Lam, the chief executive of Hong Kong, from just withdrawing that bill formally, the extradition bill, just going ahead and withdrawing it formally and putting in place a commission to independently study all these things. I'm not sure why exactly they won't allow her to do that. Maybe they don't want to lose space. Maybe they're worried that the commission will find the police cooperated with triad gangsters. Who knows what they're worried about? I also don't understand why they don't allow her. Apparently, she's offered to resign several times. Why they don't just go ahead and accept her resignation and put a temporary chief executive in place? I'm not sure why they're so intransigent, but on the other hand, that's in the nature of Xi Jinping's governance. He took over in 2012. He's always been very sort of aggressive and assertive and unyielding in many ways, but I think it's really backfiring clearly in the case of Hong Kong.
Catherine Chu, with those potential options, whether it's the, you know, the use of the police or these paramilitary groups, or perhaps just accepting Carrie Lam's resignation or announcing that the extradition bill has been permanently removed, etc. At this point, would that be enough to stop the protests, or is something larger going on and the expectation is that the protests are really not about a policy or a decision right now, but about something larger?
Yeah, something is larger is, I think, the last demand, like the universal suffrage for the chief executive and the legislative council, I think this kind of like become the most important, not one of the most important demands, but about the resignation of Carrie Lam, I think if you check the five demands from the Hong Kong people, actually that is not on that list. So whether she's still in power or whether she stepped down, actually no one cares, because everyone know that actually she's just a puppet. She doesn't has any power to actually do something, because right now she's just like a machine, like a recording machine, and then to just repeat the words that already written by the CCP, because we can check about the vocabulary that she used, actually is exactly the same as the opinion piece from the China Daily or the People's Daily from the Chinese propaganda newspaper. So no one cares about her, I think, from the Hong Kong people's perspective. So resignation is nothing. We don't care. But if for the future, how can we stop? I think directly respond to the five demands. Like number one, completely. Okay, you have to use that exact word to use to completely withdraw the bill, because that is the legislative language. It's not about the political language like the bill is dead. But we want them to officially to use that legislative language, withdrawal, that term. And second, because right now it defined the protest. Most of the time actually it's peaceful, but they still keep calling every day the press conference from the police officer or the press conference from the government, they keep calling real riot. Or even the Chinese government, they even say some like the symbol or some sign of a terrorism. So I don't think Hong Kong people will accept all these kind of terms. They have to change, and then they need to back down, okay? So I think they need to directly respond to the five demands, the demand from the Hong Kong people. Then I think the protest will stop. And one more thing, I think like Professor Lynch already mentioned, the march, actually they already applied a permit to march on the coming Sunday, but actually right now we are predicting that the protests or the protests and or maybe other marches will keep coming, because the university and all the college actually is going to begin this week and next week. And then the school, like for example, like Chinese University, the Hong Kong, actually they already mentioned about the boycotting of the school. They are not going to the school because they continue the protest. And then I think once when the college, when they all start school, the whole atmosphere will become more and more vibrant. And I think the whole society will bring up by the young people, especially the college the students. Yes.
Pradeep, this is serving as a really, you know, potentially important test case for the Chinese government to see how well they might be able to respond to these types of protests, you know, ideally, you know, without violence. What ultimately do you think China's response would be or should be? And you know, how important is it that China avoid any accusations of, you know, violence or even of manipulation, and signal, whether it's to Taiwan or to any of the nations within the region, that this is a different China? This is not your father's China.
Exactly. I mean, I agree with Catherine there that Carrie Lam is really, she doesn't really have the power. She appears there from time to time and makes a few statements, but really the real power lies in Beijing, and whatever Beijing wants will happen. And therefore, this is really astounding that these protests have been going on for 3 months. And I mean, I remember my student activist days in India, if you protested for a week, you will get a dialogue with the government. But the government in Beijing seems to be completely tone deaf. They are not willing to engage in any dialogue. They do not want Carrie Lam, although she said that she wants to have a dialogue. But really, there is no potential for dialogue there, at least so far from what I can gather. But As to how this is going to resolve, I'm not really sure how it's going to resolve, but I see it as a continuation of Xi Jinping's policies within China, because we've seen that any potential for political reform under Xi Jinping has been pushed back. There is no conversation, there is no talk about political reform. Every Chinese leader since Deng Xiaoping has talked about political reform, but we have never seen such lack of movement as we are seeing now under Xi Jinping. And I think this is consistent with that internal approach to dealing with demands for political change within mainland China, that the Chinese authorities really don't know how to respond to the protests in Hong Kong, because clearly there are significant demands. In my opinion, the demands have now moved beyond the extradition bill. I think this is more about Hong Kong's future from now on, but also particularly after 2047. You know, what happens to Hong Kong after 2047? I think the protesters want much more. They want to see, elections to the Legislative Council, universal suffrage, in other words. They want to have a say in the election of the chief executive of Hong Kong. And I don't think the Beijing really have any, they have any response to this. They do not want to accept the demands, but at the same time, they seem incapable of engaging in any negotiations with the protesters.
Can I respond?
Yes, please do it, Catherine.
Yeah, I think all of us are political scientists, and then all of you, I think you are more senior than me. So I'm keep thinking about right now the Hong Kong system, the so-called one country, two systems. It's exactly, I think, some of it, we should think about this kind of like theory or even practical thing. So what I mean is, okay, right now the Hong Kong government is not a democratic government, but it's not completely an authoritarian regime. But this Hong Kong government is in the middle. And right now, our demands, we request of the Hong Kong government to change. But we all know this Hong Kong government actually is not work for the Hong Kong people. Actually, the whole government right now, they are work for the Beijing government. So this government couldn't really accountable because it's not quite a democracy, not a democratic government. But at the same time, this Hong Kong government is not an authoritarian regime, because it kind of like we still have some kind of election every 4 years, and then half of our legislative seat actually can be voted by the Hong Kong people. So it seems like we believe our system is a little bit different from the authoritarian regime like China. So Hong Kong is different from China, right? The Hong Kong government is also different from China. But this fundamental institution problem, this one country, two system, I think is the root cause for this protest right now. Because the government is so tricky, the Hong Kong government, I mean. This government is, I think, in our world history or political history or political theory, we never seen a government like this. Right? Am I right? So I'm just raising a question. What do you other professors think about this? Okay, this government, one country, two system. But right, this actually is totally a theoretical or institution problem right now we are facing. And actually, this is the root causes for this crisis.
And you also have Hong Kong as a super well-educated, wealthy,
exactly,
interlinked,
yes,
city that's been running in authoritarian fashion. Can I make another point, though, that I think we want to make sure not to lose? So it sounds like we're all generally, and for good reason, sympathetic to the Hong Kong protesters and Hong Kong's ambitions and desire to maintain, it's a relatively liberal political system and so on. But there are some worrying dimensions to the protest, too, especially some of the protesters overdo it on the anti-mainlanders sentiment. For example, at a university in Hong Kong this week, some students were called out for chanting, basically, build the wall, build that wall. In other words, build a wall to wall out students from mainland China. And the thing is, there are a lot of very decent people from the mainland who actually are also quite sympathetic and to the protests in Hong Kong, would be even more sympathetic still if they felt it was safe to speak out. And so I think we just want to be careful. I mean, I think it's just a small minority of the Hong Kong protesters who are going that far. But I've talked with mainlander friends here who even say they're actually even a little bit worried on the weekends about going out at night because they might be targeted and beat up. In fact, there were incidents at the airport a couple of weekends ago or at least one apparently totally innocent mainlander was beaten up for just being a mainlander. So if you're taking part in these protests and you have ambitions for Hong Kong to liberalize or become democratic, it's analogous to what goes on in Taiwan, too. The split between the native Taiwanese and the Hakka people and the mainlanders who migrated in the late 40s. It's very important to not lapse into a kind of political movement that excludes people purely on the basis of ethnicity.
When we come back, we continue to discuss the protests in Hong Kong and explore the likely scenarios for resolution.
I was born by the river in a little tent. Oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. Contributing host Doug Becker continues to examine the history of Hong Kong and the causes of the protests there with China, what China's options are, and the likely international responses to China's policies.
I'm Doug Becker. Our guests are Daniel Lynch. Daniel Lynch is professor of international relations at City College in Hong Kong. His publications include The End of China's Rise. Pradeep Taneja is a lecturer in Chinese politics, political economy, and international relations at the University of Melbourne. He is also the associate of the Center for Contemporary Chinese Studies. His publications include China Since 1978. And Catherine Chu is lecturer in Asian Pacific Studies at California State University at Dominguez Hills. Her publications include So You Think You Know Chinese Film, Beyond Jackie Chan and Crouching Tiger. One of the elements that I think Beijing had counted on, you know, as far as sentiment in Hong Kong, is the fact there's been quite a bit of migration from the mainland to Hong Kong. I know in some cases it's manifested itself in violence between activists, pro-Beijing activists, paramilitaries even perhaps, and protesters. At least that's, you know, quite a bit of the news that's coming out here. But also, how tempted should Beijing be, or likely will be, to try to change some of the demographics by simply moving or encouraging migration from the mainland to Hong Kong, partially because, you know, there's economic opportunities, although, as you pointed out, there's quite a bit of division between rich and poor, haves and have-nots within Hong Kong, but also that Pradeep mentioned 2047, that by 2047, the demographics of mainland Chinese versus, I guess, for lack of a better term, native Hong Kong, the native Hong Kong population is going to be quite a bit different than it is today because of migration.
Right now, Chinese, they already have the immigration every day because there's a quota system, 150. So every day, there's 150 mainlanders, actually, they immigrant to Hong Kong. Okay. And this policy actually started before 1997, because before 1997, for the reason is for the family reunion. But after 1997, they continue to use this as a reason, family reunion. Actually, even though there's no longer, there's so many families still need to reunion. But they still keep this 150 Chinese people, they keep moving to Hong Kong. So right now, we believe there's already over 1.5 million those immigrants. Actually, they move to Hong Kong after 1997. Actually, they already make up a big chunk of the population of Hong Kong.
And Dan, what sort of impact there?
I think part of that is that movement has been facilitated by Hong Kong elites who frankly, are trying to curry favor with Beijing at the expense of some of the pan-democratic forces and so on. So, I mean, maybe eventually they would get around to limiting some of those flows. I think a more immediate irritant to a lot of people is every day coming down from Shenzhen, you have so-called parallel traders who go to drugstores, pharmacies, grocery stores, and buy up a lot of high-quality consumer goods. and like health-related consumer goods in particular, and then take them back up into China, where a lot of those health-related consumer goods aren't very high quality, to say the least. And so every day, you know, the train stations get clogged with people pushing suitcases to fill up with goods. Those kind of things sound minor, but they get on people's nerves. And so I think if they could limit some of that, and that's actually been one of the demands of some of the protesters up north near the border. But let me just say one other thing about that. It's not just the physical presence of people from China, from the mainland. That physical presence is not necessarily itself a problem. But you also have, because a lot of this is being waged through social media and on the Internet. For some reason, which I can't figure out, the Xi Jinping propaganda strategy through social media and the Internet has been to mobilize very vicious, hostile 5%, 50 cent, you know, the umao, the 50 cent trolls to viciously insult Hong Kong people and denigrate them and call them, you know, running dogs of the Americans and the British and on and on. And we will bury you because you're not as talented as us. I can't understand for the life of me why the PRC propaganda, the CCP propaganda strategy is to insult and malign Hong Kongers through the Internet and social media. If anything, they should be doing the opposite, trying to find common ground and acknowledge the reasonable positions of the protests and so on. Instead, they're fanning the flames through every day. And I've talked with all kinds of Hong Kong friends who really hate those 50 cent brigade people, because they just constantly are fanning the flames and irritating people. So just rein those people in online, and you're already going to make some progress, I think.
First Pradeep, and then Catherine, please.
Just going to add to Dan's comment about fanning the flames. I mean, you see that happening in other parts of the world, particularly here in Australia. We've had demonstrations and counter demonstrations by mainland Chinese, you know, students who are studying in universities in Australia. We saw that in University of Queensland. We've seen that in here in Melbourne. And there is really foul language being used by, you know, mainland Chinese students. And I'm not sure whether there is clearly a backing of the Chinese embassies and consulate here. But certainly in Brisbane, there was a case where the Chinese consul general there made a statement in support of those counter-protests. So it's not only the trolls, but it's also the alienation that Hong Kong students are feeling from the mainland in the form of these counter-protests and trolling by Chinese students in other parts of the world too.
Catherine Chu.
About the political campaign, about the propaganda campaign, I'm sorry, okay, propaganda campaign. It's very interesting is how did the Chinese government using this kind of propaganda campaign. And then as I think I'm writing on my paper there is my argument is a soft power, this term, okay, defined by Joseph Nye. Usually we use it to describe about the foreign policy or about the international image. And then I think previous most of the study on Chinese soft power, we focus on that part of study. But I think the soft power to the Chinese government or to most of the Chinese, actually they don't care. I couldn't say that they don't care about international image, but when they have this kind of propaganda campaign, actually the major target for them is still the domestic people. It's not for the international audience. It's not for the foreign audience. The whole this propaganda, how did they describe about the Hong Kong protester? They still using a lot of Chinese internet, like the WeChat or the Weibo thing. So the major target is deal to the domestic people. That's why we are for the Hong Kong people, because we have our own like the social media. We use WhatsApp. We don't use WeChat, even though a lot of Hong Kong people, they also use WeChat, because when they need to travel to China, they have to use the WeChat. But most of us, okay, when we come back to Hong Kong, we use WhatsApp. And then we divided ourselves into two. That's when we talk to the Chinese people, we use some of other social media. But when we talk about the Hong Kong people, we use our own thing. So we know that. So that's why a lot of young people, if they don't read the newspaper, because most of the Hong Kong newspaper, Chinese media, actually is already very communist, very pro-Beijing. So most of the young people, as far as I knew, okay, they actually, most of them, they don't read Chinese newspaper. And they don't watch the TV, because the TV right now, they call it CCTV-B. It means the China Central TV is already propaganda thing, so they don't watch that TV. Most of them, they watch the internet TV, and then the internet TV, because they don't have those strict regulation by the Hong Kong government, so they have more freedom of speech. And also the host of those internet TV is more like pro-democracy or not like those pro-Beijing. So the propaganda thing is totally just for the mainlanders, for the people who speak Mandarin, the people who only use the Chinese. And for those people, if they could read English or non-Chinese, I don't think they actually will like to read all those message from the Chinese government.
So ultimately, viewing this from the outside, like I am here in the United States, what kind of impact can international actors have on these ongoing protests and, you know, the possibility for greater violence? Are we observers and we're watching this play out? Or are there tools that could potentially be in place for international actors? Pradeep had mentioned the G7 statement, which the Chinese immediately had rejected. Are mild protests coming from outside actors about all that's possible, all that's available to international actors? Or are there varied potential campaigns or responses, either from citizenry internationally or from governments? Daniel Lynch.
There's something very specific right now going on in the United States, actually. Mm-hmm. You know, in 1992, the U.S. passed the Hong Kong Policy Act, right, which grants Hong Kong a special status in international economic and legal terms apart from the mainland, which is what allows Hong Kong to play such an important role in the overall Chinese economy. And then, and I just called it up on my computer right here, on June 13th of this year, in the Congress was introduced a new Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act. And it would reinforce the Hong Kong Policy Act of 1992 and threaten to withdraw some of those special privileges and the special status granted to Hong Kong, depending on how events unfold. So this is something, I'm not sure what's going on in Australia and in other countries, but this is something that the U.S. government right now is, the U.S. Congress right now is considering as a way to put pressure on China to handle Hong Kong carefully, let's put it that way. In fact, there's a petition going around among academics and others. I signed that petition. I'm looking to see if Catherine has signed that petition. I imagine she'll get around to it sooner rather than later. There is a lot of pressure on Congress. And by the way, this is completely across the aisle. It's put Democrats and Republicans both agree on the importance of Hong Kong retaining its liberties and ideally advancing its liberties. And they agree on opposing strongly any sort of forceful mainland intervention in Hong Kong.
Although that issue is certainly complicated by the trade war and trade negotiations, certainly out of the White House.
Everything's complicated by the White House these days. That's right. But you know, you had Nancy Pelosi in the House, and you had Mitch McConnell in the Senate, as leaders of the House and Senate, respectively. Both issued statements as early as June in tandem with the introduction of this new proposed bill, the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act. So the more level heads in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party are in agreement that the Hong Kong crisis has to be taken very seriously. Eventually, if this act passes, it would go to the desk of President Trump, and then we would just see what he might do. Obviously, very unpredictable to know what President Trump might do. But he hasn't misbehaved too badly, I think, on Hong Kong. He's been generally restrained. You know, of course, he praised Xi Jinping once there for handling it well, but then he said it's a problem in U.S.-China relations. So I don't think he's mishandled Hong Kong yet, and so I'm somewhat cautiously optimistic that he'll continue to play as positive a role as he's capable of playing in a situation like this.
And Pradeep?
Well, one of the consequences of China's economic rise has been this growing interdependence between China and other countries in the region. In Australia, for example, government is very cautious about saying anything about the Hong Kong situation apart from calling for calm in Hong Kong. And that's largely because of a very sensitive sort of relationship. Australia is one of the few countries that actually runs a trade surplus with China. And although China looms large in much of the public discourse in Australia at the moment, but and there has been a great deal of concern expressed by civil society organizations about the situation in Hong Kong. But the governments in the region, including here in Australia, are very, very cautious about, you know, what they're going to say or not say about Hong Kong. I mean, ideally, I think if this situation is to be resolved peacefully and at least it leads to some change in Hong Kong, you would expect that governments in the region would have to, you know, lend a degree of support to the protesters in Hong Kong. But unfortunately, because of these economic concerns, governments are very reluctant to do anything about it.
And Catherine, in particular, from your perspective, what would you encourage?
I think the protesters in Hong Kong, since the beginning in June, they already have their view is they have to this kind of connection with the global community, especially the global civil society. So if you still remember, actually started from June 25th, because that time is around like the G20. So the Hong Kong people just within 2 days, and then they have the crowd funding money, and then they got a couple $1 million, and then they already have the advertisement in 20 international newspaper. That's the first time. And the second time started from the mid-August, just 2 weeks ago. Actually, they also have another international newspaper, this kind of advertising commercial campaign. And then they also crowding, the funding, the money very ambitiously. They already got a couple $1 million to do that. So they, since the beginning, they already have this view that is they need to connect with the global community and also the global civil society. And just by today, if you check about Twitter, there is a very trendy tweet called Stop the Coup, because there's something happened in London. And then actually the London protesters, they inspired by the Hong Kong protests. They already have the slogan that they just don't want to look like Hong Kong. And the forum that I joined quite actively, they already have a campaign that they want to connect with the London people and because we all fight for democracy, fight for freedom. So everything. So right now, whenever there's any place, if they have a protest and ask for demand for democracy, demand for freedom, I think the people from Hong Kong, they will try to connect them. And then we have this kind of all global connection and to fight with the, right now, the strongest, the most powerful authoritarian regime in the world. China, I mean.
You're listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. Today we are discussing the ongoing protests in Hong Kong and China's response to those protests. Our guests are Daniel Lynch at City College in Hong Kong, Pradeep Taneja at the University of Melbourne, and Catherine Chu at California State University, Dominguez Hills. I'm going to ask the one question that we political scientists usually cringe to ask, but I'm particularly curious in this case, and I'll ask it of all three of you and start with Dan Lynch. Ultimately, how do you think these protests end? Is there a peaceful, you know, means where they'll end? Will they peter out? Will there be some sort of forceful response from China? And how do you see the relationship between China and Hong Kong, say, in the year, 2025?
Well, thanks for that question, Doug. That's just such a softball. I'm going to hit it out of the park right now. No, I don't know. I don't know, and I don't think anybody knows exactly how these will end. I mean, I think Catherine made a terrific point of earlier when she noted that since students returned, actually we just had our student orientation this week for new students. Student classes start on Monday when the strike has been called, the class strike has been called. Now younger people are coming back together on campuses, and so not only can they rely on social media to communicate with each other and to coordinate protests, but they'll be seeing each other face-to-face and dining halls and so on and so forth. So I imagine over the next end of September, things are going to become even more tense. But again, the countervailing moves that Xi Jinping could make are so obvious. Catherine also made a good point when she noted that it's not just a matter of withdrawing the bill formally, or establishing an independent commission, or even having Carrie Lam resign to tamp down the demonstrations. But the thing is, it's not either all or nothing. If those three things happen, I think you'd have 90% of the people who were demonstrating then being satisfied enough and stay home. Of course, you're always going to have some people who want democracy now, full universal suffrage, and so on and so forth. But at least the vast majority of protesters would be mollified. They wouldn't be happy about that outcome because they do have greater aspirations. So I think I think they would be at least temporarily mollified until the next provocation from the government. So if cooler heads prevail, if Xi Jinping wants to have a smooth and peaceful October 1st, 70th anniversary of the founding of the PRC, who wants to have some hope of relatively pro-China candidates winning in the Taiwan legislative elections in January. I don't think he's going to win a presidential election in Taiwan. I don't think the pro-China candidate can do that now. But at least have sort of a milder response in the Taiwan elections. And if he wants to manage the U.S.-China relationship so that it doesn't completely spiral out of control, he will restrain himself and possibly find a way to allow Kerry or pressure Kerry to go ahead and make some easy concessions just to tamp things out. He'll be papering over the problem and kicking the can down the road. But I think there is some hope that not this next March, but starting in the fall, that things could quiet down. So.
Pradeep, Tanasia, the same question.
Well, I agree with Dan. I mean, it's very difficult to predict what exactly is going to happen, how China is actually going to respond to the situation. But, I mean, I know what I would like to see happen. I would like to see China, in fact, engage in a dialogue. And the dialogue should lead to at least some of the demands being met, some progress being made. And in fact, in the long run, it'll be good for China, too, because China has long had this policy of having these enclaves where they conduct experiments on economic policy. And I always thought that after 1997, Hong Kong would actually provide that platform for some conversation about political reform in China also. So in the long run, I think it will be good for China to begin this dialogue in Hong Kong, and perhaps that could have implications for political reform in China.
And Catherine Chu?
I think to answer this question, we need to divide it into different levels. For example, like the individual level, the society level, or maybe upper government level. But first of all, I want to share about the individual level as people come from Hong Kong, was born in Hong Kong, raised in Hong Kong. First of all, a lot of people, a lot of protesters right now, actually, they already went. If you read the newspaper, read the interview. One very common sentence they use is, Hong Kong will never return back to same as the past after this movement, after this 3 month or maybe even longer protester in the future. So the relationship between the Hong Kong people and the Chinese people, I think it will only getting separated even further apart, I think. That's what my prediction in 2025. Not only because right now after this protest, our identity will get stronger and stronger. And even for me, okay, because I'm actually already like a kind of like outlier from my friends and then from my colleagues in Hong Kong, because I think I live in United States for too long. But for them, I think they really get a very, very strong feeling that is right now they are Hong Kong and then they don't want to bother with everything about China. Even though we also concerned about democracy, probably maybe in 2005, we went to the June 4, 1989, that night to remember about the Tiananmen massacre, because we still think, okay, if Chinese got democracy, and then our Hong Kong will also get the democracy. But right now, no one would believe that because we know, okay, we actually just don't care about Chinese. I'm so sorry about my kiss. I'm so sorry. So we just cannot go back to the relationship between Chinese and Hong Kong. And then most of my friends, they just want to stay in Hong Kong. They don't want to leave Hong Kong. They want to stick in Hong Kong because they think this is their home, right? So from the individual level, I think this identity is really even stronger. And I think for the future, our study, we need to restudy about this identity issue of Hong Kong, because I think, for example, a professor from the Chinese University of Hong Kong, Eric Ma, long time ago, he already mentioned about the identity of Hong Kong people actually is quite tricky because we don't have a nation. Even throughout my education under the British colony, I don't actually have very strong identity that who am I. But right now, finally, I think the identity issue for Hong Kong people is we regain our identity because we know that we are Hong Kong people. We are Hong Konger. We can claim ourselves we are not Chinese, maybe, okay, possible in the future. So this is from the individual level. And then I think from the government level, I think right now, it's quite obvious to show to the world that this is an authoritarian regime. And then Hong Kong, even though we came with this as one country, two system, but we know that this government is totally like just nothing, because he is this government isn't work for the Hong Kong people and just work for the Beijing. And then right now they try to solve the issue because the reading from them is they think this is an economic issue. They think because the young people, they couldn't buy the very expensive apartment. So they try to have a plan, okay, to give more subsidies, to give more allowance to the younger generation. But it won't work because basically right now it's not the economic issue, because most of the Hong Kong family are quite well-being. Even though our apartment is very small, only 500 square inches, it's very small, but we already get used to this crowded environment. Right now, the root cause is not economy, it's political issue. It's because of the one country, two system. It's about this institution issue. So I think for the government, they really need to tackle on this one country, two system. It basically show it doesn't work. It didn't work, it doesn't work, and then it will not work after 2019. They really need to change kind of like some kind of reform. Whether you can make it one country, one system. Actually, we don't scare. I mean, the Hong Kong people, a lot of us actually, we claim, okay, why not just send the PLA, the People's Liberal Army, to Hong Kong? We don't care, okay? If you send the people, the PLA come, and then we just go home to sleep. Okay, then you can take over Hong Kong, and then fine. Then all the financial center, that one country, one system, all the foreign investment company, they are going to leave. They will leave Hong Kong, and then so all the Chinese communists, I mean the party member, their family also got their money all gone, right? If this one country, two system. So we actually don't scare about the PLA if they come to Hong Kong. Because we really need them to, you have to change, okay? Right now, the government, you need to work for the people, the Hong Kong people.
Thank you very much. I think it's pretty clear what the stakes are in these ongoing protests. And this is clearly a story that we're going to need to continue to follow, to observe, to see how this all turns out. Thank you very much to our guests.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Doug.
Daniel Lynch is professor of international relations at City College in Hong Kong. His publications include The End of China's Rise. Pradeep Taneja is a lecturer in Chinese politics, political economy, and international relations at the University of Melbourne. He is also the associate of the Center for Contemporary Chinese Studies and a fellow of the Australia-India Institute. His publications include China Since 1978. And Catherine Chu is lecturer in Asian Pacific Studies at California State University at Dominguez Hills. Her publications include So You Think You Know Chinese Film, Beyond Jackie Chan, and Crouching Tiger.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Agassian, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.